Accession number 28699, Reel 8.
Mr. Casey, Reel 8. You were fighting in the Bocage. I think we've touched upon the Bocage, but it was a very, very difficult area to fight through.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, because it was the hedgerows, mainly, that made the problem. Quite high, some of the hedges, and they're pretty thick. So you're going along the road, well, somebody fires, and they're well hidden in the hedges and so on, or the little orchards. And often you didn't know where the hell to fire back at first. And you'd get down and maybe call up some mortars, artillery or something. But it was difficult. It was a very good place for defending. You know, I mean, you got loads of cover. And we were out in the open.
Crossing those very small fields with high hedgerows must have been extremely difficult.
Well, it was, and that's why, you know, you always got casualties. You'd try going up the edge of the hedgerows, you know, instead of walking up down the middle, you'd walk up by the side of the hedges on either side. So you're kind of able to support each other if somebody opened up. But it was great when we got into open country.
And I'm assuming mortars must have been important.
Yes.
For getting just beyond the,
that's
know,
right,
high fire.
Yes, we had, you know, each platoon had its own mortar. And I had a thing there. One of my fellas, he went, he's bomb happy, we used to call it. He went completely. He was a runner in my platoon. And the sergeant came up and said he'd gone. Well, I can't remember his name anyway. I wouldn't say his name if I remembered it. But he'd taken the 2-inch mortar with him. So we couldn't put down any smoke or anything. And I said, I'll shoot the sod when I see him. Anyway, he came back and he was so pathetic, you know. I didn't even charge him with desertion or anything. I just sent him back and said, you know, it's gone, the nerve's gone and he can't help it. But I did have a go at him and I said, if you'd only left a bloody 2-inch mortar, I wouldn't have cared. But you took it with you, silly sod, you know.
Did you all have a certain amount of sympathy with chaps who
called? Oh, yes. I always, two things I found. One is they just became kind of paralysed, couldn't move. Or they put themselves in more danger, usually. I can remember one lad when we were in slit trenches and we were being shelled or mortared, I can't remember. And he suddenly jumped out of the slit trench and started running around. And I jumped out of my slit trench and rugby tackled him. And the NCO came out as well and we dragged him back into the slit trench. And then I sent him back. I said, he's bomb happy, it's gone. Because he's going to get himself killed. He's running round out of the slit trench. So I don't think he ever had any problem in knowing when somebody had really gone. It would be a temporary thing. Like I was saying about the lad who pulled my revolver on. That was just a temporary thing. But when they went, really, what we used to call bomb happy, that was it. And usually, as I say, they either put themselves in more danger or they just couldn't move.
Could you see it coming at times with some men?
Well,
that they were beginning to, you know, crack on.
It was difficult to know because, you know, people would be very apprehensive of, and they've just been through something and they're reluctant to do any more. You see, this the biggest mistake people make, civilians particularly, is veterans. They'll be the ones, the veterans. Because the veterans usually have had enough, you know, and they're going to hang back or they're not going to go. And that's why I say when I did patrols, I took one man and we went 100 yards ahead. Because then they weren't the nerves because they knew that it was clear because we'd done it. And as I say,
I suppose they've learned to be wary, you know.
That's right.
And add up what the next object might mean to them.
That's right, and they've been through so much and seen so many people killed, and it's not an adventure. It's you've got to do that, but the odds are you might get killed. And if you've seen a lot of people being killed, it makes you think it's more likely. But as I say, I always had this feeling that officers had it easier because they had so much to occupy their minds, the objective and so on. And but the ordinary fellow, he's just walking with a rifle and he doesn't know what the hell's, you know, going to hit him next.
Coming back to the Bocage experiences, I suppose a gap in the hedgerow must have been a lethal place.
Yes, yeah.
The Germans would have.
That's right. You just looked and hoped and ran and then walked and ran and walked and, you know, had people spread out on either side as much as you could. And it's like, I don't know what I talked about when these Poles who were in the German army surrendered. I don't know whether they talked about that. Well, this was a move when the battalion was moving forward, and they said they thought the Germans had pulled out, but we had to make sure. So my company was told, so that meant I was told to the lead. And the colonel spoke to me and he said, I want you to go behind the first section with the radio and give me a running commentary all the time yourself. And that was the only time I didn't go in front. The only time in the whole campaign I didn't walk in front. And the first section went through, way behind the hedgerow, and suddenly mortars, we thought it was mortars, it was rifle grenades, I think, and fire, machine gun fire, rifle fire. And this section dived into the hedgerow, but one man came back. And how he got back, I don't know. His foot was hanging off. So I got hold of my stretcher bearer. There was silence, you know, a few minutes. So I said, right, we're going to walk down the edge of the hedgerow and keep that Red Cross stuck out in front, and let's hope they take some notice of it. But the first sign of anything, we'd dive in the hedgerow. Anyway, we got about 30 yards, and five or six Germans ran out with their hands up. But there were Poles who were shouting, Polski, Nix Deutsch, Polski. And I thought, the bastards, they could have just surrendered. And actually, they'd killed all my section except this one lad whose leg was hanging off. Well, my platoon just shot forward, shouting, kill the bastards, shoot, bastards. And somehow I stopped them. I don't know how, but I stopped them. And I said, the colonel wants to interrogate them. So I said to my sergeant, take them back, and a couple of men, you take them back to headquarters. And I said, they've got to get back alive. I don't care how fit they are, but they've got to be alive to talk. So he took them back. I don't know what happened on the way, but they were there. But I always stopped my fellas from killing them, I don't know, because it was pointless. There was no need for them to do it. And then they said, Polski, Pole. And somebody said, cigarette. One of my fellas hit him with a rifle, yeah. But it was such a waste of life and nothing.
Farmhouses in the Bocage, were they usual German strong points?
Yes, yes, yes.
Farms, of course, buildings.
Buildings, yes. Oh, yes. You learn to sort of, kind of, if not attack them, at least manoeuvre around them. So, you know, looking, expecting something.
Sure, you wouldn't put in a frontal attack against
them. Oh, no, no, no. No, you'd just send people round and gradually get closer. And if nothing happened, somebody went in. But we found that, you know, if there was only a couple in there or something, they probably would give up when they knew there was a whole platoon going around. Not like these Polish idiots who killed well, I suppose, seven of my men for no reason.
Mines and booby traps, are we coming across those in
yes.
advance?
The fellow I told you about, I took with me on patrols and things, he was killed by a booby trap. And it was so tragic because he had got to this little building and he'd stopped outside and he was down on one knee with his rifle in his hand. And some other fella went in and there was a battle or something and he turned the tap and it blew up and blew him up, but it killed this lad who was outside, who was a marvellous soldier. And
do you remember his name?
No, I can't remember his name. That's terrible, really. But I remember going once when we had to move at night and it was pouring with rain. And we thought we were going to be taken out of the line, but in fact we were moved to another position. And when I went round, first light, people had dug themselves in as best they could with things over them. And he had got a very shallow slit trench with a big bush thing over it, and he'd got his Mac, his waterproof, and he's got his rifle all dry, and he'd got a field of view, and he said, "Is this all right, sir?" And he was fabulous, and this stupid bastard turned the thing and got him killed.
What kind of things were they booby trapping? You mentioned the tap there. But what are they?
Well, all kinds of things. I mean, anything to do with booze or things that my people might take as souvenirs, and they booby trap them. I mean, I always said I wouldn't have any of those. I said, "There's only one thing I'm taking back, me," and I wouldn't have anything that was in a house or anywhere. Because so often things were booby trapped.
Souvenirs are, an attraction, aren't they, to
oh, yes.
people?
Well, the only souvenir I ever got, somebody gave them to me. I remember getting, it was when the war ended, and we had to go round, rounding up people. And I took my section of carriers round the coast. And there was this marine place. And these binoculars, fantastic binoculars looking out to sea. So, and weapons we just threw in the sea. You see. But I said to the lads, I said, "Now, I don't know what you're going to get, but those are my binoculars from her father." So I got them, and another lad took them home on leave, gave it to my father for the races. And he said, "Oh, God, Jim. They're fantastic," he said. You can see the jockey changing his mind. And this is, I mean, during the war, a bookmaker offered him £100 for them. I mean, that's a fantastic amount of money. Because you couldn't buy binoculars, you see. And they were about over a foot long and fabulous. So,
were they booby trapping the dead? Were they booby trapping the
dead? No, I didn't come across that. I didn't come across that. But dead, and one of the nastiest things I had was when we were pinned down. Well, we're in this little area and we had all slit trenches dug, and I had this little sort of shed which I was using as headquarters and keeping a fire going. But about 3 yards away was a dead German, and we couldn't move him, you know, not for till it was well in the dark, you know. And it was awful, terrible. But that's when I ignored Rumble. We'd got this thing, it was snow on the ground, you know. Terrific. I don't know, minus 20 or something. And he said everybody had to stay in the slit trenches all night. Nobody was allowed to get out of the slit trenches. Because he's back at some headquarters thing. So I got this little shed, got a fire going, and I said, "Right, now everybody gets 5 minutes round the fire every hour. And, you know, they come out, you go back, come out." So two at a time or three at a time would come and sit round the fire and then go back to the slit trenches. And the sergeant said, well, I should say hell with him. I said, anyway, he'll never know because he's not coming round here to drop me shells. they were coming, frozen stiff. And then you just had this little 5 minutes or so round a fire, you know. Because apparently the whole corps artillery was concentrated on this small area we were in. And they're just incessant shelling. and, you know, they would never have survived the night. So I, you know, disobeyed orders. I thought, well, as I say, he'll never come. He won't know.
German prisoners, did you take any around? Do you recall taking them and what condition they were in the Lange Bocage area?
No, I didn't get any prisoners there. There were prisoners, you know, but my platoon, we didn't get any.
What about snipers? Were they active in the Bocage?
Yes. Oh, yes, yes. And this lad who was killed, he was used to snipe, be a sniper for us. And he said, I wish I was sniping for the Germans, because he said I could pick all the officers out, because they're all wearing berries and suede shoes and corduroy trousers and things, you know. And then the order came out that we all had to wear ordinary uniform and tin hats, although they didn't. But, you know...
What cover were snipers using?
I don't think I recall one, so no. It's just you going along and somebody would be hit. But
that must have angered chaps to be shot in that way. They mustn't have liked snipers.
Oh, no. But it wasn't a great deal of it. I mean, it was more attacks and things with us. Not a great deal of sniping that I remember. You know, one or two were hit. But it was more artillery, mortars, and actual gunfire, you know, as far as we've concerned, that we faced.
After Langevin, and after you've rested, you've obviously gone back into the line, and you're still in the Normandy Bocage, obviously, for quite some time after that.
Yeah.
Do you recall what happened to you next?
No, not next, not in that sense. I mean, it was just repetitive. You advanced to another village or something, and then we had the breakout.
Just before the breakout, almost immediately prior to the breakout, there was the action at Mont Pinson, Pincon, as the lads used to call it, Plessis Grimaud is.
Yeah.
And you attacked a couple of hills, 249, 262. I think this was where Dennis Hurst was killed.
Yes.
Do you recall that particular
action? Not particularly. I mean, I suppose it was different than it had been, but it was still the same in a way. It was, that's the object, and this time, that's the object, which is up there. So you didn't... It wasn't like Mount Cassino or something where famous battles and... With us, it was... This time you're attacking on the flat and this time you're attacking up a hill. But it's the same thing, sort of, business. And then it was, as you say, just before the breakout that I went into the carrier platoon.
Yes, he was your immediate...
He was my boss, you see, yeah. He was the captain... I was a lieutenant.
And he was killed there?
He was killed there, yeah.
Do you remember much about him as a person and officer?
I wasn't with him very long. Very short time.
So what happened then? You were in the carrier platoon?
I was the second in command, you see, of the carrier platoon. And then this fellow, what's it called, Goddard?
Gardner.
He came from somewhere else, another battalion, and took over as carrier platoon commander. But as I say, he reversed the roles, really, because he used to look after the admin and ammunition and, you know, all the carriers being repaired and so on.
Can you describe your carrier platoon, or your carrier platoon to me, the number of carriers, etc.?
Well, that's 13 carriers. one of which was a flamethrower. So I'd my own, and then there'd be 12 in be four sections, I think. Is it? Was it four sections of three? There was three in a section. So I think we had four sections. And the Carapetung commanders. And the flamethrower, yeah.
How did the flamethrower work from a carrier?
Well, it was... it's just the same as with the tank. You had this nozzle thing, and behind it was the equipment that, you know, sets the thing on fire, and you just pressed the gun, and the fuel shot out and lit. I don't think we ever used it, really.
What's the role of a carrier platoon in a battalion?
Well, it's a lot of it is patrolling, and you'd lead the battalion when it was moving, or you'd have somebody leading and somebody on the flanks. But then mostly it was patrolling. It was, you know, they'd send the carriers off a couple of miles up that way to find out what was going on. And then occasionally, in an attack, you'd use them to carry... Well, in fact, you were carrying infantry. I mean, your own fellows, not extra men, but what happened was you got, I think it was something like 50-odd, 60 men. So you could transport that number of men to an action. But some people had the wrong idea, you see. They seemed to think that carriers were like tanks. Well, anything other than a 303 bullet would go through them. An armour-piercing bullet, or a shell, or a mortar, anything. But people often thought of them as like bulletproof, but they weren't.
I suppose anyone above is firing straight down into it anyway.
Yes, oh yes. Yeah. It was really very little protection, but more able to move troops quickly, that's all. In, you know, you've got the rest of them walking, and suddenly you can send 20, 30 men fast to some point, and then they became ordinary infantry once they got there.
What was the usual crew of a carrier?
Three, I think. Weren't it? One? Before. Four. I think it was four.
That was the driver?
The driver, the gunner in front, and two others. I think it was four. Let's say 12. Yeah, it's about four, I think.
Were there, in your opinion, a good vehicle?
I think, yes, I think they were very good, and they were useful. As I say, they transported men quickly, and also, you know, they went off on patrols, and you had a bit of speed to get in and out of places. I thought they were very useful, and I enjoyed being in the carrier, having the carrier platoon. It was better than walking. I remember I also had, I think it was five motorbikes. So I rode a motorbike most of the time. And they always give it this feeling of tremendous power, a motorbike. That's why they're dangerous, I think. You know, the speed thing gets you. And I remember when we were stuck at some place and there was a bridge, small bridge, or a narrow bridge. And so the colonel said, right, we want to get across this bridge, see what the, you know, what it's like, what opposition there is, something. He said to me, you know, you'll get somebody across that bridge. And so I said, well, I think it'd better be me, isn't it? So I descended the bridge and revving up, and I shot across the bridge. You know, by the time I got halfway, I must have been doing 60 hours. And there was nothing there, fortunately. And also the same thing happened when we were doing the moving, the whole lot of us. But we've been shelled at this particular part. And we tried to time it so that I got everybody ready, revving up. And the shells landed, and as soon as it landed, they said, "Go!" And we all shot across before the next lot of shells could come, yeah. But you had this thing with a motorbike that gave you a terrific feeling of power.